Well, welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm joined by Ron Stutz, the WCHL's handyman and helper all the time when we're able to persuade Vicki Jarrett, the editor of Our State Magazine, to come and talk about North Carolina as she's looking at it through the current issue of Our State. And the current issue is the June 2007 issue, which is just hit my mailbox. Vicki Jarrett, welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us about what you got in mind for this issue.
Well, we have a lot of things packed into this issue, but our feature section is really focused on the Carolina cupboard and some of our favorite foods, things that are just essentially North Carolinian in nature. For example, we have a story about Outer Banks food traditions, including hard crab stew and fig cake. And we have a wonderful story about Moravian chicken pie, which raises the question, is it a Moravian chicken pie because the chickens are Moravian? That was actually a question raised by our writer for that story. But just all kinds of articles about a lady who has won hundreds and hundreds of ribbons at state and county fairs, and this is just something that she and her family love to do together. And she will can just about anything and give it a try, and she's won numerous blue ribbons and red ribbons. And so we've just covered a whole range of subjects, and by the time you get through with this issue, you're just going to have to go out and try a recipe or two or go find your favorite place to eat.
Well, I'm not interested in food. As you
know. Oh, I've heard that about you.
No, I tell you what, we're going to talk about one of the articles later on about food, and then but if we talk about it too much now, I'll just be too hungry and I'll have to take a break. You know, one of my favorite Our State authors is a Chapel Hill woman who lives in Edenton, I guess, part of the time, but we see her in Chapel Hill a lot, Catherine Kopp. And so Catherine has joined us, and Catherine, you're writing, you got a great article about something that all of us ought to go see in Elizabeth City, but you're writing from a Chapel Hill perspective, right? You're writing for Chapel Hill people. Tell us what Chapel Hill people ought to know about a wonderful museum in Elizabeth City.
Well, the museum is called the Museum of the Albemarle, and, you know, the northeastern corner of North Carolina is sort of the forgotten corner of the state, although I have to say it's getting discovered lately, but there are a lot of things in this part of the state that people from the Triangle or the Southeast or, you know, West and Charlotte aren't very familiar with. And there's a wonderful new museum in Elizabeth City, which is a branch of the North Carolina Museum of History, and it's called the Museum of the Albemarle. And it's actually, there has been a facility in Elizabeth City for, I believe, about 30 years, but they moved last year into a brand new building down on the waterfront in Elizabeth City, and they're in the process of getting all their exhibits in place, and we'll have a big grand opening spring 2008. Now a portion of the museum is open, and there's some work in progress going on, but it's a wonderful facility that I think will be a big draw for people from across the state and visitors to the Outer Banks. It'd be a great day trip if you're down at the beach.
Well, they've got a museum. Have they got anything in it?
They do have some things in it. There's some special exhibits that are rotating, and then actually the museum is sort of telling the history of this part of North Carolina, and they have exhibits that kind of go through the stages of the history of northeastern North Carolina. There's a maritime Albemarle exhibit, which talks about kind of the early history of the state with Native Americans, and then as settlers came in from England and other places, there's a maritime, the maritime exhibit is followed by a canal era exhibit, which talks a little bit about the Dismal Swamp Canal, which came in the 1800s, and the railroad exhibit, and then up to the automobile and the tourist era. But there are a couple of buildings that have been reconstructed inside the museum that are a big part of the historical exhibit, and there's a house that was built in the 1700s called the Jackson House, and a smokehouse that was built in the 1800s, and those were actually located in northeastern North Carolina, and they were disassembled and moved to the museum and have been put back together inside the museum by a master craftsman.
And I should say that's actually what attracted our attention to this story. We've been kind of watching the progress of the new museum site as it, you know, they've been working on it and projecting the opening toward next spring. But especially interested in what they're doing with those two buildings and how they're using that to incorporate into this, as you described it, this history of that corner of the state, which, like you say, does not get a lot of attention from most of the rest of North Carolina.
Well, the Jackson House is a really neat, it's really quite a small frame structure, although an architectural historian named Tom Butchko, who's at the museum and who has written several books about historic homes in North Carolina, he said for its time it was a pretty good-sized house, but it's basically a two-room cabin with a little loft, and there's a lot of the original material, the paneling inside, fireplaces, and they're using it also as kind of a teaching exhibition for school children in the area. And even as it's been reconstructed this spring, they've had groups of visitors to the museum and school kids coming in to watch Russ Steele, who's the craftsman who's working on it, actually putting it back together again. So it's really an interesting project.
Wasn't this house especially considered fine for its time period because of details like having a floor as opposed to a dirt floor?
Right. It has a wooden floor
glass in the windows.
Instead of a dirt floor.
Mm-hmm.
It had glass windows, and a lot of homes built in the 1700s would have just had some kind of, you know, either wooden shutters you close, mm-hmm. or even a heavy canvas cloth that would cover the windows. So the glass windows were a sign that it was quite a fine house when it was built.
Well, y'all are giving Ron Stutz some good ideas about how he might improve his house. Ron, you want to put a floor in
well,
there.
Is Ron doing some remodeling?
Yeah, I'm all excited because since the beginning of this program, I have a brand new title. I've gotten a promotion here at WCHL, Helper and Handyman, which means I should be able to do some of this stuff by myself.
You should be able to do a floor and glass windows.
And nothing could be further from the truth. I can't do anything. I can drive a nail. That's about it.
Yeah, you're the guy who can do everything. Ron Stutz, one day we're just going to have a special program to celebrate you.
Jack of all trades.
You are
master of none.
My hero in everything. You know, museums in North Carolina are interesting to me, and since I have a, since I am Scotch-Irish, not Scots-Irish, I'm Scotch-Irish, I squeeze a penny pretty hard. And how much does it cost to visit this museum?
Gosh, I believe it's about $5, but I'm not positive. And there are different rates for seniors and school children.
Okay. Well, I want to turn, you know, you mentioned that this has an affiliation or is really under the sponsorship of the North Carolina Museum of History.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And Vicki Jarrett, our editor, has just made a visit over to Raleigh, which is a little bit closer than Elizabeth City, but Vicki, what did you learn about the North Carolina Museum of History while you were over there visiting with them earlier? What's up over there?
Well, what was exciting about my time then, I got to meet with the North Carolina Museum of History Associates. So these are people who are regularly doing fundraisers and working on programs for the museum and just supporting the museum in every way imaginable. And what was very exciting to me was just to see their enthusiasm and to realize that the preservation of our heritage is in very good hands and that there's, you know, no lack of interest in doing that. So,
well, did you see something over there when you were, I know you went to give a talk rather than to...
I gave a talk and I didn't have a chance to spend a lot of time walking around the
museum.
All
right, well, if you're not going to tell us what you saw, tell us what you told them.
What did I tell?
Yeah.
That's a long speech.
Well, just, what did you talk about?
I mostly talked about, about the magazine and about our interest in preserving the heritage and culture of North Carolina and just how important it was that we all care about the state and its people. And I think that's what makes North Carolina stand out and to be special.
Well,
among all the states.
Yeah, that's a great message, and it is one of the reasons why I think most of us love your magazine so much is because you give us many reasons each month to appreciate things that we hadn't even thought of. In this article by Chapel Hill's own Catherine Kopp about the new museum at Elizabeth City is just one example of the many things that you put on our list of things that we've got to do. And Catherine, thanks. We miss you.
Well,
Chapel
thanks
Hill.
For having me. Look, and come see the museum.
We will do it.
And come by and visit me on your way.
Your husband, I think, works in Elizabeth City. Maybe
he actually does. And we went to a very nice fundraiser for the Albemarle Hospital Foundation, at which supplements the cost of medical care for patients that don't have health insurance, and it was held at the Museum of the Albemarle.
Wow.
So it's the facility's a great big
space. All right, well, we're going
to
get in the bus one day and just come to visit, and you got to give us a tour.
Okay, I'll do it.
Thanks so much, Catherine. Now, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Vicki Jarrett, Ron Stutz, and I will explore another part of North Carolina through the pages of Our State magazine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Ron Stutz and I are visiting with Vicki Jarrett about the June issue of Our State magazine. We're exploring North Carolina through the pages of that magazine. It's always fun. Welcome, Vicki Jarrett. Thanks for helping.
Oh, my pleasure.
We're
getting ready to talk about one of the really good stories that's just going to whet your appetite for more.
Oh, my golly. Well, Ron Stutz, I think you said this is your favorite story. Why don't you sort of introduce it?
Well, Janet Pittard is here today, and I was just telling Janet a moment ago, I really enjoyed her story about beach music, the origins of beach music in North Carolina, and all the people who made it what it was, and the comments from Charlie Brown and all these people in there. So, Janet, good job on that story. We all enjoyed reading it.
Well, thank you. I hope y'all are dancing.
Well, that, of course, was last month's issue. And Janet has another one for this month about cooking.
That's right. Janet wrote a wonderful story about Ellen Powell, who is a cook in Reidsville. But, Janet, be sure that you share with us the story about the tomato aspic.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know that writing these stories for Our State magazine, I get to meet some of the most interesting and delightful people. And I believe, no pun intended, that Ellen Powell takes the cake. She is one of the most gracious people that I have ever met, and I think that from now on, when I think of Southern ladyhood, Ellen Powell be who comes to mind. She was just great fun to interview, and that's not just because she served me lunch and had three desserts at her house. She was just a joy to talk to. What a delightful person, and what a wonderful outlook on life.
Tell us all about her. Tell us the specifics about this woman. Why is she so important and so nice?
Ellen has worked a number of different jobs and always had a reputation in Rockingham County for being a great cook, and she was the chef at the local country club for many years and catered lots of weddings, so lots of people knew about her cooking, and everybody said when she got ready to retire, why don't you write a cookbook? And so she did. And she wrote Cabbages to Caviar, which had a lot of the recipes from her country club cooking days. And then most recently, she has written a new cookbook called Sweet Tea and Magnolias, which is truly about as Southern as you can get.
It's sweet tea.
Sweet tea with lots of E's.
Well, Ron Stutz, that reminds us of Bob Seymour's campaign to rejuvenate sweet tea and the advocates for sweet tea in Chapel Hill, where we have so many visitors from outside our region who came unprepared to accept the superiority of sweet tea over flavored tea.
I think, you know, it's a shame when you go into a restaurant and you say, I like sweet tea. They say, we don't have sweet tea. We have it unsweetened and there's sugar on the table. Well, it doesn't work like that. I'm sorry.
It's not the same thing.
It doesn't taste the same. I mean, on the eighth day, God made sweet tea is what Robert Seymour always says.
And
after
Ellen
had had a good breath.
Him out. Ellen had a great lunch for my brother and myself when we joined her, and she talked not just about cooking and her recipes and her cookbook, but about the way she looks at life. And I think she has found the key to serenity, and it's probably in her kitchen and in her garden. She is real interested in cooking, of course, but she gardens and grows her own herbs and finds a lot of satisfaction in cooking for other people and cooks for the church and takes meals to people that that just need an uplift or have had something going on in their family where they need a little boost. And so she's quite familiar to folks in the Rockingham County for her cooking and has helped the rest of the state out by putting all that together in a cookbook. And I have been trying lots of her recipes and as a consequence have put on 5 pounds, which I'm trying desperately to do something about. But
you're not going to help if Vicki keeps giving you stories like this.
I know.
You're going to balloon
we'll
up.
We'll have to go back to tagging, won't we?
Well, when we were doing the story, I tried the tomato aspic recipe, which we've reproduced in the magazine, and I thought that there was a mistake in the recipe because I served it for a dinner party, and my goodness gracious, it just about knocked your socks off. It had 2 tablespoons of Tabasco in it. And I've never used Tabasco in much of anything before, and it comes in that little bitty bottle, so I thought this must be pretty strong stuff. And, you know, it takes a while. It has a little spout. It takes a while to load up 2 tablespoons. And I was just shaking that thing and shaking that thing, and I thought, this sure seems like a lot of this stuff. But that's what it says in here, and I fixed that tomato aspic and I served it, and it was really, really good, but it will flat take the skin off the roof of your mouth. So when we put it in the magazine, I talked to Ellen Powell and she laughed and she said, no, that's not a mistake. She said it's just a little spicy.
She did tone it down.
Did
email me and said, if we can stop the presses, we need to correct this mistake. And then she emailed me again and said, no, it's correct, but I don't think anybody's going to want to make it that hot.
Now, this is I wish that everybody who's listening could have the magazine in front of them to see the recipe, because I think it's a story in itself that you've got a wonderful cook that we're featuring in our state magazine who has given us a straight-out recipe in her book about how to make tomato aspic. And then you've got a conspiracy between the editor of our state magazine and the writer of this story, both of whom are with us and stand accused of changing the recipe.
With her permission.
But this is a great thing for a young cook to do, is to go get your Our State magazine, turn to page 114, and get the recipe for tomato aspic, which is one of the most wonderful classic Southern dishes, and make it both ways and see which one you like, whether you like the 2 tablespoons
or the 2 teaspoons. That's right.
It's also the first time I can ever remember hearing about Janet Pittard even thinking about toning it down.
Well, listen, we got to take a break, Ron Stutz, I hate, and you want to ask Janet one more question about dancing?
Oh, yeah. Are you still shagging? That's the thing I want to know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I am still shagging and hope to keep it up. I can't keep it up for quite as long, but I love to dance.
Maybe I'll see you.
Peel yourselves off the wall and get out there and join me.
Maybe I'll see you sometime on the coast of North Carolina this summer.
Absolutely.
Well, Janet, we'll look forward to the next time you write for Our State. It's always fun, and you're so good to share your experiences with us on WCHL. Look forward to seeing you sometime, or visiting with you sometime soon.
Thank you. Take care.
We'll be right back talking to Vicki Jarrett, editor of Our State Magazine, and Ron Stutz. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting, Ron Stutz and I are visiting with Vicki Jarrett, the editor of Our State Magazine. And Vicki has taken us all over North Carolina and then bringing us back to Chapel Hill from time to time through the pages of Our State Magazine. And she's made it possible for us to talk about some of our favorite stories. And one of them is a story called A Homegrown Success by Charles Blackburn. And Vicki, tell us why you wanted this story. What's this story about?
Well, I'll tell you, the best way I can explain why we wanted this story is a comment that a lady made to me yesterday. She had just read this article, and she said, "I want you to know that Carly Sees has been a part of our family." She said, "We just have always shopped there. We always get their products." You know, and she just went on and on describing her connection to Carly Sees, and that really is the heart of why we wanted to include Carly Sees as part of this feature.
What is Carly Sees?
Well, there are multiple things. I think we have Charles here on the phone to talk to us about it. Not only is Carly Sees a grocery store chain, but they also have their own line of food products, including country ham and barbecue sauce and something that Charles referred to as green gold.
Well, we do have Charles Blackburn, one of your regular authors of Our State and one of our great friends here in Chapel Hill. Charles, let me ask you the same question. What's so special about this, and why would it be of interest to anybody in Chapel Hill?
Well, I personally was very pleased to be assigned this story because it was a kind of an interactive thing in that they have a whole line of tasty products that, of course, I had to sample. That includes country ham and sausage and green gold, the cooked frozen collards that they do. That they got into all of this kind of tangentially to the grocery store operation, just that they had various things that Mr. Carly C. had developed, and people kept asking for them, and before you knew it, he had a whole line of products. And
well, Charles, I don't know. There are no Carly Sees in Chapel Hill. Where could we go to if we wanted to shop there?
Well, their stores are the headquarters is in Dunn, and the stores are kind of in that area: Benson, Spring Lake, Lillington. They've got three in Fayetteville.
So up and down I-95.
Down I-95. Now, when I talked to them 6 weeks or so ago, they were thinking about offering some of their products online where they would ship them to people. And so eventually they may do that. It's just www.carlyces.com, carlyces.com. So people may be able to get these things directly through them.
Well, now, all right, your special products, but now, a grocery store is a grocery store, isn't it? I mean, why would I stop next time I'm driving by on I-95 in Dunn or one of those other places? Where is there any reason for me to stop? What would I get out of a stop there?
Well, certainly these products would be worth the trip, but the thing about this operation is just really a great North Carolina story of a family business that grew from very small beginnings.
Well, tell us that story. Tell us the story.
Well, Carly C. and his wife Joyce started out really with a small store just selling Nabs and Cokes, and this was in Johnson County next door to Harnett where they lived, and but they lost their lease, and they decided they'd get a little bit larger place. Well, business continued to be good, and they got various family members to come in with them and started expanding. And today they have 12 stores in 9 communities, and it really makes them one of the largest independent grocery store chains in the country.
Wow. Well, how do they compete? I mean, you know, we think that there's just, we think that even, you know, the larger chain stores can't compete with the, you know, the new competition by Walmart and the mega stores. And how does a small independent grocery store compete price-wise with?
Well, one of the ways they eventually became affiliated with the Independent Grocers Alliance, the IGA stores, and which that whole chain was founded back 80 years ago in response to pressure from the growth of grocery store chains, and for the very reason you mentioned, that how are they going to compete? And this is how they were able to do it, by banding together the independent grocers, and they have warehouses and so forth where they can remain competitive with the bigger chains.
There is a great quote in here, I believe, by Carly C's son, Mac. He says, "We share IGA's belief that a good grocery store shouldn't be an impersonal cookie-cutter branch of some distant conglomerate." And that is probably the thing that keeps people coming back to Carly C's.
Yeah, well, Ron says, I'm trying to think, have we got anything left in Chapel Hill that approaches kind of an independent grocery store?
Well, I guess the closest thing to total independence would be Weaver Street Market, you know.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of other grocery stores around. I mean, Whole Foods is pretty big.
These are disappear. These sort of the family-owned grocery, which was a staple of my growing-up years, the corner grocery store where you could walk or the bicycle delivery person could deliver, that's gone. And what is the closest thing to it? Charles, it sounds like this might be the closest thing to the old-time grocery store.
And there's a real personal connection. People really feel like it's their store.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that kind of brought that to the fore, their main store burned down back in 1984, and they didn't have any insurance. And, you know, for most businesses, that would be a crippling blow. But the community really rallied around them, and sympathetic businesses and so forth, and they opened only 5 months later, reopened. And every employee that they'd had came back and were willing to take up where they'd left off.
Wow. You know,
I think that kind of is an indication of how people feel about the business. They've also been very good at giving back to the community, too.
Well, I tell you, you've persuaded me. I'm going down there and get some of that country ham and collards that they sell off the shelf and enjoy the experience that you've described of visiting.
It's well worth it.
But now, Charles, I can't let you go without getting you to tell us about a book that you reviewed in this month's the June issue of Our State that has something to do with Chapel Hill. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. It's a wonderful book by Ruth Little that the UNC Press has put out. And it's called The Town and Gown Architecture of Chapel Hill, which really is kind of unusual. There have been a number of books, picture books, one thing and another, about the architecture on the campus, on the UNC campus. But this really is the first one to look at kind of the diversity of architecture in the whole community, from colonial revival to modernism and everything in between. And it really gives you a sense of kind of what a remarkable place architecturally the town is, and mainly because of a real procession of talented architects, some who came and did work at the university and others who were, you know, building homes for people privately, but a steady procession that's come through the community and really left their mark.
Charles, help me with this, and this is kind of an unfair question, but I'm telling you, I'm going to ask you anyway. And that is, those of us, Ron Stutz and I live in Chapel Hill, we drive up and down the streets, and for us, the houses, and I have to say to some extent the university buildings themselves, we get so used to them that they're unremarkable to us. And so you're kind of an outsider, not really, but you're kind of an outsider. Is there something as you explored this book that kind of leapt out at you, that, or is something that we just ought to go see? if we live in
Chattanooga? Well, I think the overall impression, I guess, is just that the whole really is greater than the sum of its parts. When I went to school at UNC and were familiar with certain areas, but this really takes you all out in the community to places, you know, that the average student probably didn't walk to see. But the book is also includes some maps and so forth that really is a useful guidebook to go and see some of these homes. The Horace Williams house, various things you think of, but this will take you out to where the post-war subdivisions, these sort of ideas first came into being, and just shows you what a wide array of styles are available in this one town.
Well, we'll get, I think all of us ought to promote Ruth Little and the book that she's written, and we're complimented that, Vicki, that Our State Magazine would review it in the Tar Heel Literature section, and that you'd get such a distinguished literary person as Charles Blackburn to review this book for us. And so we're thrilled we're going to go buy it and go examine our own town. Charles, thanks for visiting with us.
Sure.
Well, there's more in Our State Magazine. I have to say, even Charles, with you, that my favorite article is yet to be discussed, and we'll do it in the next hour.
That's because, he wrote it.
I have an idea.
Guess which one.
Ron Stutz, Vicki Gerin, I'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Vicki Gerin and I are talking with Ron Stutz. Vicki Gerin is the editor of Our State Magazine, and she's taken us all across North Carolina through the pages of the June 2007 issue. Vicki, how am I going to say this? We visited with some of your really fine authors about some of the places they visited, some of the people they talked to.
I've got a good way you can get into it.
Okay.
Let's hear.
Maybe you better do it. I'm having a hard time.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the grand finale.
Well, of course, we have a wonderful article that you wrote, DG, about Wayland Baum. And I have to tell you that we probably hung on to this story idea for too long, because it did take us a while to get around to saying, yes, we want this article for the magazine. And I'm not really sure why the hesitation, but it is a great article. He's a very interesting person. He's 102 years old, and he apparently is showing no signs of slowing down whatsoever. And it's just one of these people who's a character with a capital C, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I was. It's you know, a lot of people, Vicki, come to me and say, how do they pick their articles?
And we hang them up on the wall and we throw a dart.
Well, the story, I'd be interested in your side of this story. My side of the story is I was over at Robert and Cynthia Bashford's, my good friends who live in Chapel Hill, and Cynthia's brother and his wife who live in One Cheese were there, and she started, Lulu started, who lives in One Cheese, started telling me, you ought to write an article about our neighbor. And I've heard this 1,000 times, so I kind of go into a zone of saying, you know, that's real interesting, we'll think about it. Mm-hmm. And that's where I went, and she said, you know, this man used to be a lighthouse keeper, and this man is 102 years old, and I look out my window and I see him climbing up on his ladder to paint his house. And then she started, and so I'm all of a sudden I'm out of my zone. I'm saying, wow, 102 years old up on a ladder painting his house. And then she talked about his experience as a lighthouse keeper, as a guide, and that he would his mental faculties were still alert. He'd go down and talk to the school kids, and when he celebrated his 102nd birthday, the story was that he took $2 bills to give out. I said, I'm calling Vicki right now.
Timing was really good, because we've had different readers email us and say essentially the same thing. There's this fella that you need to do a story about. Just a couple little details, nothing too substantial. But when you came and said all of this, you know, it started to gel together as a story idea we could really go after.
Well, I'm...
So timing is everything.
I'm fortunate to have been to have gotten the assignment, but it was interesting. The thing that knocked me over, Vicki, when I called you, I mean, you put yourself in Vicki's place. She gets 1,000 ideas a day from the favorite ideas of everybody who thinks that particular thing ought to be an article, and she's got to sort them out. But when she said, I've already heard about this 1,000 times, I said, oh, my golly. Well, why hadn't you written the article? Why hadn't, thank goodness that you hadn't done the article, because I want to do it.
DG,
we
you're
were saving it for you, DG.
You said he was 102 years old, but I can't speak for Vicki, but he sounds like he's younger than we are.
That sounds very true.
The things that he does. Gosh.
You know, everybody I talk to about him, you know, it's like the houses in Chapel Hill that we talked about in the last segment. You know, you got a 102-year-old person living next door to you and is out and about and active. You get used to it. You know, it gets to be part of the landscape. But when I hear about it, I hear this guy, he doesn't remember it, but the story has been told to him so often that I can, as he told it to me, I could visualize it about his daddy, who was a real lighthouse keeper, and I think this took place at the Hatteras Lighthouse, that this lighthouse keeper, under one arm, has got, I guess, a 5-gallon or a substantial barrel of kerosene, and under the other arm, he's got his little boy, you know, a year old little boy, carrying him up the stairs all the way to the top of the lighthouse, because the little boy's his mama is beautiful but ill, and you know, sickly, and so he's got to take care of nobody else to take care of the little boy, so they're up there on top, you know, of the lighthouse.
Well, and I should say that, you know, we didn't choose to do the story because he's 102 years old and very active, although that's all remarkable, but here's a man who has an extraordinary life experience that not very many people still living can claim, which is that he was a lighthouse keeper, he and his father. And it's such a piece of North Carolina history, right? They are wrapped up in this one man, you know, and when you open with that account of his father tucking him under his arm and carrying him up to the top of the lighthouse, you know, it's such a personal history, and yet it's so much a part of the fabric of these coastal lighthouses that we're so proud of as our heritage.
Not only that, but we have such a reverence for lighthouses in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
We all love them, and when you think about all the experiences that this one man has had in regards to lighthouses and the coastline, I mean, that's a remarkable story right there.
Well, you know, there is I want to talk some more about the story, except we're going to run out of time because I'll get going preaching about the story and we'll have to just stop in the middle, but there is a Chapel Hill connection. And this would be a great question for you in the morning, Ron. What is the Chapel Hill's connection to Captain Waylon Baum?
Maybe Freddie Conger knows, but I don't.
Freddie, well, think about Baum's jewelry.
Oh!
And I was downtown just the other day and ran into Claire Baum, who I hadn't seen in a number of years. And so I told her that I'd written this article about Waylon, about a lighthouse keeper who might be kin to her family. She said, oh, yeah, Waylon Baum, he's kin. We're all kin. And she told the story back to me before I even mentioned it. But
how is he related to Claire?
Well, she's related to Claire's husband.
Oh, okay.
Walter, who is, you know, they're in the jewelry business in Chapel mm-hmm. Hill. But her husband came from, from that area, I don't think they actually lived on the Outer Banks, but they lived right on the coast. And those families are all connected, and they have a Baum family reunion where they get together. And so as a result of Vicki letting me write this article, I have an extra special new connection to a Chapel Hill family
mm-hmm.
And a greater appreciation about how the families of North Carolina stick together and know about each other. And you better not ever say anything bad about anybody, because it's going to be kin to the person you're talking to.
That's right. Well, and he has a special connection to North Carolina as well. Didn't you say that he had had the opportunity to be assigned somewhere else in the country.
Oh,
and
it's...
declined the assignment because he did not want to leave North Carolina.
All of his life, he wanted to move. He was a temporary lighthouse keeper. He wanted to get in the permanent lighthouse service. That was a big, big deal. Daddy had been in the lighthouse service, and he, you know, but he'd just been a substitute. You can put yourself in his shoes. And the door of opportunity opened for him to be a real lighthouse keeper. But it was in Maryland. So he said, I can't leave North Carolina. Mm. I'm staying. And so for the next 85 years, he became a charter a fisherman, a charter a guide, a hunting guide, and a charter fisherman, and a commercial fisherman, I think. Did all of these things on the coast.
And so that right there is why we call the magazine Our State Magazine, because that's how we feel about North Carolina, you know?
It really is a great state.
It's great. Vicki, the nicest thing, and I was glad you left this in there, even though it's hard to pick up on, but he said... at the end, he said, you know, I said, how you get along economically? He said, I'm doing better than I ever did. He said, I'm working with Morgan Stanley. So he's put his money in Morgan Stanley. You know, he saved, he apparently never spent any money, and he saved it, and Morgan Stanley's managing it for him, and he's very happy.
Well, I'm so glad he's doing well.
Well, guys, this has just been great. Vicki Jarrett and Ron Stutz and some of the other authors of articles in Our State Magazine, the June issue, have been visiting. And Vicki, as always, thanks for taking us around North Carolina.
Oh, my pleasure.
And thanks for the great magazine, Ron Stutz. Thanks. It's always a pleasure to deal with you, buddy.
Yeah, it's always fun to talk about Our State with Vicki.
Appreciate all of y'all listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.